This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 24th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 335. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The new Sin Bin feature and the Big Deal feature. Justin Trudeau, David Eby, and Ken Sim have it all figured out. They want to build to solve the affordable housing crisis. But UBC Professor Emeritus David Lay says they are wrong and their plans are likely to backfire. David Lay is the author of Millionaire Migrants and Housing Booms in Gateway Cities. Hear his speech to the Local Democracy Project's March 20th forum. This is the Sin Bin, or should it be congratulations to the Vancouver Sun and Global TV. The Vancouver Sun and Global TV finally noticed last week that crews are logging Stanley Park. The park board is spending about $7 million to chop down 160,000 trees that it says were killed by the looper moth infestation and drought. That's a quarter of the trees in Vancouver's jewel. But the major media attention is too late. Park board contractors started cutting trees down in October and are pretty much finished. Anyone who walks or drives around Stanley Park can see that trees are obviously dead. But anyone who walks or drives in the park can also see stumps and logs that are obviously healthy. They cut down too much. The Breaker.News has been a voice in the wilderness, shaking the tree at Park Board and City Hall since last fall. Please read my stories. Look on the Breaker.News or search the Stumpy Park hashtag on X, formerly Twitter. Since the pandemic, governments have gotten bigger and the media has gotten smaller. It's bad news for democracy and bad news for people who love their parks and the environment. The lack of public communication, the lack of public consultation, and the lack of public disclosure from the Park Board and City Hall about Stanley Park is truly shocking. Almost as shocking as the sorry state of Stanley Park. Hopefully, maybe, it will be a thriving forest again in a century or so, with proper care and attention. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
Less red tape, more housing built near transit, more affordable rental housing, and more density. Federal government is ready to keep being a partner with all orders of government that are ready to make progress on building more homes faster.
And we know we can't do it alone. There are huge challenges around housing. The cost of construction materials has gone up. There are labor shortages as we build out our province in so many different directions to respond to the massive population growth we've seen.
We have over a million people that are going to be coming to the Greater Vancouver region by 2050.
You've heard it from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, BC Premier David Eby, and Vancouver Mayor Ken Sim. Their solution to the affordable housing crisis is simple. Build. More towers, more condos, more apartments equals more affordable housing. But that's nonsense, says one of Canada's top geography professors. David Lay is the professor emeritus and former head of the geography department at the University of British Columbia. He has studied real estate, development, demographics, and immigration trends since the 1970s. He is the author of 2010's Millionaire Migrants, Trans-Pacific Lifelines, and 2023's Housing Booms in Gateway Cities. On March 20th, David Lay spoke at UBC Robson Square in Vancouver at the Local Democracy Project's forum on the theme of civic government, corporate, consultative, or participatory. He said that politicians are pouring more gas on the fire and they're going to hurt instead of help the people that need affordable housing in BC. Here is David Lay's speech, edited for brevity.
There's an idea doing the rounds that goes something like this. If only home builders could have access to lower density districts in the city, they could build, and provide affordable housing for the missing middle, those originally identified as falling within the 30 to 80,000 income range. I think there's been some inflation in those endpoints. But unfortunately, the story continues, those neighborhoods have been locked tight by selfish homeowners protecting existing low densities. Their stubbornness should surely be undercut through bold public intervention by brave politicians and planners upzoning those districts, opening the door to affordable development. Oh, if it were that easy. In this talk, I plan to unpack and criticize this pervasive idea that has, in some parts, become common wisdom, unexamined, unquestioned, despite the absence of persuasive evidence to support it. It's a compelling narrative for a population that is suffering from an extraordinary lack of available, affordable housing. It offers an attractively simple explanation and solution for what many believe is a complex problem with multiple causes at multiple scales and without easy fixes. Notice this narrative has something to offer both supply and demand side stakeholders. For housing suppliers, it promises new virgin territories for medium density, sometimes high density development in desirable areas they would never have expected to be allowed to build multiple unit housing. Not surprisingly, this pro-development narrative is attractive, and the real estate industry is certainly on side. Also on side is the frustrated demand, the demand of many who are shut out from the current housing market. Younger, even middle-aged households who have legitimate expectations that their economic capital, that is, their education and professional job status, warrants access to affordable rental or preferably ownership property. Their housing situation is often desperate. Of this, there is no argument. This union of supply and demand stakeholders has persuaded some governments to abandon 50 years of neighborhood plans and the public spiritedness that created them. And so we see an earlier model of urban government has returned, a model that existed in Vancouver from the mid-1930s to the late 1960s, a model that looked to the business sector for its affirmation. This model, as I'm sure many of you know, began in Vancouver with the abolition of the ward system in 1936 and the creation of a free enterprise coalition that took the mischievous and misleading name, the Nonpartisan Association. This was Paul Tennant's view of the NPA. In a very long article he wrote in 1980, he identified a party with very well-defined partisan interests. You can read, I'm sure you already have, read the quote for yourself. Now, I would ask you, does that describe any party that is more recent than the NPA in the 1960s? Sound familiar? The grand vision of the 1960s was the freeway high-rise city. Going through planning materials of the time, one is struck by the admiration for the urban freeway idea, a transportation corridor that crashed through city blocks and dismembered neighborhoods. What was noticed at the time was not destruction, but new creation. All three levels of government were at first supporters of the freeway high-rise plans, and the local media were in absolute raptures. Obsessed with this grand vision, contrary views were summarily dismissed, especially if they came from neighborhood interests. So when opposition was ignited in Strathcona by the wholesale destruction of the neighborhood from urban renewal plus the freeway alignment, the city's NPA mayor denounced local calls for a public meeting as, quote, a public disgrace, a tempest in a Chinese teapot. Participation? No thanks. Well, I hope some of you can see some tangential connections with the world we live in today, and perhaps remember George Santayana's famous phrase, the past, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. The past is being repeated in significant ways in Vancouver's urban governance. The role of business interests, a master plan that dismisses neighborhood as a concept and neighborhood residents as stakeholders, a big vision that elevates simplicity over complexity, a non-participatory political process, a view unworried by neighborhood destruction while extolling new construction. So with this in mind, how to respond to the view of local democracy as an enemy of housing affordability? Let's look at two key claims of the bold vision of upzoning. First, that low-density hoarding of land is the cause of home unaffordability. And second, and related, that loosening this pernicious control through upzoning will produce affordable housing. Well, it's asserted that single-family zoning has been blocking the building of more affordable multi-unit dwellings. Several years ago, John Rose showed that in Canadian cities, including Vancouver, net completions of new dwellings exceeded net population housing growth by up to 20% between 2001 and 2016. Vancouver's overproduction of housing was above the average, as you can see. And during this period of housing overproduction, there was rapid house price inflation, culminating in Vancouver's boom between 2013 and 2017. In addition, during this period, the share of more affordable multifamily dwellings rose steadily, while the share of detached houses fell dramatically. So we see a rapid growth of denser forms of dwellings before any upzoning occurred. These facts contradict the claims of the supply side argument for rezoning. If there's been a supply excess and a rapid expansion of higher density dwellings at the same time as prices soared, we can't blame low density zoning for the creation of unaffordable housing. Now, you might be wondering about that excess of 20% of housing production. Why, you might ask, don't we then have a vast vacancy rate in condos, in rentals around the city? One answer is a key reason why affordability has been lost. Much of the 20% has been claimed by investors. Real estate has become a major investment asset in the past 40 years, fueled by low interest rates. Typically, investors can outcompete buyers whose revenues are restricted to their meager employment income. And this is a really quite extraordinary figure that puts, for Vancouver, the benchmark housing price index against the real median income index. And there you see the creation of the affordability gap. So what's happening here is that there's a decoupling between wages and house prices, creating an affordability. And I'm not going to say anything about the wage side of this, but that is also a really important topic, that wages have remained so low and scarcely increasing over such a long period. Investors provide what I call surplus demand. That is, demand in excess of the households who will actually live in dwellings. And that surplus demand has been steadily growing. Investors are particularly important in housing booms, where they were, if I may use a rugby expression, they pile on. They pile on to what they see as a good thing, rising prices. Now, the Sydney data also gives us another interesting piece of information. It shows us where the investors came from in general terms. Australia has very generous tax system for property investment. And in fact, the majority of investors in Sydney were Australians. A minority, a significant minority, but nonetheless a minority, were largely from Asia. Now, this investor presence, especially the overseas investor presence, has expanded with the globalization of the real estate market. This was first noticed here after Expo 86, shortly after the joint Sino-British declaration over the return of Hong Kong to the mainland. After that was signed, then we started to get immigration and property investment coming from Hong Kong in particular, not just Hong Kong, but at that time, Hong Kong in particular. Vancouver became a destination for large amounts of trans-Pacific property investment in the years following the sale of the Expo site. Here's a figure of the scale of outbound real estate investment from China in those years that John looked at, or at least the latter ones, from 2009 to 2016. And this is only institutional investors. This does not include individual investors. You see this great surge of capital that left China during that period. It primed Vancouver's 2013 to 17 boom, just like Sydney's. And here you see, in fact, in the Sydney case, during the boom, the real estate share from China, so that 52% of Chinese investment proposals that went into real estate amounted to 24 billion Australian in 2014 to 15, doubling from the year before. So here's the scale of capital moving in. With the present collapse of the Chinese housing market, there is evidence this capital flow is picking up again. This is from Juwai, the global real estate platform based in Hong Kong and Shanghai. It's a platform that is introducing Asian investors to global property markets. And you can see its big statement here. Of course, domestic and overseas investors alone have not fueled housing booms. We need to think also of national scale pressures, like the withdrawal of senior government from social housing. Immigration policy, including the business immigration program, and Bank of Canada monetary policy, amongst others, and not least has been the role of a property growth machine within this province. These regional, national, and global effects on affordability far surpass any defensive barricades raised by homeowners to protect neighborhood zoning. But let's end up by looking at the second issue, whether upzoning will indeed produce affordable housing. The objective here, remember, is to make the market affordable to the missing middle, frequently identified as essential workers who are being priced out of the city and even the region. This is an admirable intent, but sadly, I fear the outcomes will not be due to high and rising land values. Consider the Broadway plan to densify dozens of blocks along the Broadway corridor. Upzoning will raise the value of land and cause the demolition of existing older rentals, of which there are many in these old neighborhoods. The rule of thumb in this city is that old units are affordable and new units are not affordable, because new units incorporate current land costs, labor, and materials costs. According to CMHC data, the average rental cost in Vancouver for a one-bedroom unit built before 1990, so an older unit, was approximately $1,700 a month last year. For a new one-bedroom unit built between 2020 and 2023, the monthly rental, again last year, was exactly 50% higher, $2,550 a month. That would require an income of $102,000 with the 30% rule. So who are we building new units for? Not the missing middle. What will happen to the minimum wage worker renting the average bachelor unit, who, according to CMHC data, is already spending more than 50% of their income on rent? I'm afraid we will be witnessing evictions and government-led gentrification. And with a vacancy rate of 0.6% for one-bedroom apartments, no amount of city relocation policy can put that right. There's nowhere to go. The survival options are the options that we will see increasingly. Living in camper vans, homelessness, encampments. I fear that current policy, plus the federal immigration policy, which is reckless in terms of the capacity of cities to provide services, including housing services, for this population, I think that this is simply an inevitable outcome. Now, these conclusions I presented to you are not mine alone. They're shared by a growing number of researchers. In the US, a recent review of upzoning in a number of cities reached this conclusion. Cases as disparate as Chicago and Houston show that deregulation allowing increased density and a greater mix of housing types produces higher housing costs, increases displacement, and accelerates gentrification. I'm sorry, I could not be more cheerful.
David Lay is the Professor Emeritus and former head of the Geography Department at the University of British Columbia. He is the author of 2010's Millionaire Migrants, Trans-Pacific Lifelines, and 2023's Housing Booms in Gateway Cities. On March 20th, David Lay spoke at UBC Robson Square in Vancouver at the Local Democracy Project's forum on the theme of civic government, corporate, consultative, or participatory. News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, vast majority of Taiwanese and Hong Kongers support democracy. The Pew Research Center survey found that 84% of Taiwanese and 82% of Hong Kongers believe the multi-party democracy is better than a single-party system, ruled by experts, ruled by a strong leader, or ruled by the military. However, in Hong Kong, there was 43% support for rule by experts. Meanwhile, just 18% of Taiwanese like the idea. Hong Kong is ruled by the single-party Chinese Communist Party. Just this week, Hong Kong passed Article 23, a new security law that further erodes civil law and buttresses the CCP's authority. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Article 23, Hong Kong slams malicious ex-governor Chris Patten, accusing security law critics of fact-twisting. The homegrown security law has been criticized by rights NGOs, Western states, and the United Nations as vague, broad, and regressive. But authorities cite perceived foreign interference and a constitutional duty to close loopholes after the 2019 protests and unrest. Patten on Tuesday decried, quote, another large nail in the coffin, end quote, of human rights and the rule of law, claiming that the joint declaration, which gave rise to Hong Kong's handover, had been breached again by China. In the Kyoto News, Japan policy paper to focus on U.S.-Philippine ties to counter China. With Beijing's territorial claims and expanding military activities in mind, Japan, the United States, and the Philippines have been strengthening security collaboration in recent years. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is set to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden and Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. on April 11th in Washington, D.C., the first ever trilateral summit for the countries. They are expected to agree on deeper cooperation. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Portland Tribune, Yogesh Raut of Vancouver, Washington wins Jeopardy Tournament of Champions. Raut takes home $250,000 for the victory. He's a social and personality psychologist who lives in Vancouver, Washington. Raut also earned a spot on the second season of Jeopardy! Masters with the win. In Crosscut, a decade after Oso landslide, Washington works to improve preparedness. The Snohomish County disaster killed 43 residents on March 22, 2014. Today, geologists can better help people get out of harm's way due to boosts in tech and millions of dollars of state and federal funding. A memorial was unveiled in Oso on the 10th anniversary. In the Times Colonist, company behind Capital Regional District Biosolids sued in U.S. over health issues, animal deaths. Sinagro Technologies is a majority owner in the residual treatment facility at Heartland. A group of Texas farmers is suing Sinagro, claiming fertilizer made from a product of sewage treatment in Fort Worth, Texas, is making them sick and killing their animals. CRD spokesman Andy Orr said biosolids from Victoria have not been used in agriculture. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the scientists, doctors, and activists who keep the fight against big tobacco and keep helping people stop smoking and stop vaping. April 1st is Take Down Tobacco Day, formerly known as Kick Butts Day. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 24th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 24th of March in 1989, 35 years ago, the Exxon Valdez tanker ran aground, spilling 240,000 barrels of oil off the coast of Alaska? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. or follow the Breaker News on X, formerly Twitter, for news as it happens. And you can support the Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.